If you follow national politics, you've probably been watching what's happening in Texas. Republican state lawmakers there want to redraw congressional maps to try to increase the number of GOP seats in the House of Representatives before the midterm elections. Could that kind of redistricting happen in the tri-state? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our regional politics show, we'll talk about the potential for redistricting, along with what federal Medicaid changes could mean for each state, and what state officials are doing about affordable housing and rising property taxes. Joining me now are Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith, and Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman. Welcome back, everybody.
Happy to be here.
Great to be here.
Great to be here.
Brandon, Vice President J.D. Vance was in Indianapolis last week and talked about redistricting when he met with the governor and other Republican leaders. What can you tell us about those discussions?
Well, not a lot came out from what actually happened in the meeting. Certainly the governor didn't talk much about it. The governor described it as he and the Republican legislative leaders listening to Vice President Vance. And what's happening now is Republican leaders at the State House are talking to their colleagues. They're talking to their caucuses of lawmakers about, hey, should we do this? What do you think? Right now, what I'm hearing is not a lot of really excitement around the idea of coming in and redrawing Indiana's legislative or congressional district map. They can do it very easily in Indiana. Unlike in Texas, where you've seen Democrats flee the state in order to deny a quorum, here in Indiana, Republicans have supermajorities in both the House and the Senate. So even if every Democrat left the state, Republicans could still come in, pass a new map, without any, you know, really without any issues. So it's not a question of can they do it? It's a question of is there an appetite to do it? And at most, you'd get two seats. Right now, the split in Indiana is 7 Republicans, 2 Democrats. And there is some concern among Republicans that by redrawing the maps, and you've seen this echoed in Texas, by redrawing the map, yeah, could you draw maps that would probably get both of those Democrats out of office? Sure. But what you would do is you would take 7 very, very safe Republican districts and maybe 3 of them, if not more, maybe 4, but at least 3 of them would become much closer in a wave election year for Democrats. They might be at risk. And they would also potentially produce a different kind of Republican than the ones who are currently in office. Indiana, like in a lot of states that are run by conservatives across the country, have very, very conservative federal lawmakers, not moderates at all. But the way you'd have to redraw these districts, particularly around Indianapolis, by splitting Indianapolis into several pieces, you'd potentially produce districts that a more moderate Republican would have to run in to have that kind of success that they're looking for. And so it would change sort of the political face of the congressional delegation in some ways that I don't think maybe some Republicans in the state are gung-ho about.
Well, Brandon, do Indiana's Republican leaders say they think the current maps are fair? I mean, have they said what the reason would be to redraw them? Would it be specifically to help the Trump administration?
If that's the only reason, because, I mean, even Governor Braun last week, before the vice presidential visit, was asked about redrawing the maps. And he said, yeah, our maps are great. They're compact. They consider communities of interest. They don't have any weird lines going any place. Like, he made a case for how good the maps are. And so the only case to redraw them would be, you know, as he put it, to basically force a change in elected officials. So no, it's blatantly partisan and political. But if this is going to happen, I don't think that matters.
How have the state's Democrats responded to all this, Brandon?
Understandably angry about it. They've been holding rallies and decrying, you know, what they see is basically Republicans and President Trump and his administration trying to cheat to win the 2026 midterm elections. But again, largely powerless to stop them in any functional way.
Hmm. Well, Karen, Ohio will have to redraw its congressional map soon, right? Tell us why.
Yeah, there was a situation back when the maps were being drawn, and we're just talking about the congressional maps here, not the legislative maps, which are the maps for the state house and the state Senate. So Ohio's 15 congressional districts will have to be redrawn because of the way the vote went last time the maps were drawn. It wasn't unanimous, and so they need to be redrawn again. And so that the deadline on that is like late November, I think November 30th. So the legislature gets the opportunity to do this first. And if the legislature can't agree, and again, Republicans are in the supermajority in the House and the Senate in Ohio, then it would go to the Ohio Redistricting Commission, which is this 7-member panel dominated by Republicans that has drawn maps before. And we're hearing pressure from the White House and other officials at the Republican, other Republican officials about creating a map in Ohio that would be, instead of 10 Republicans, 5 Democrats, which is the way it is now, to more like 12 Republicans and 3 Democrats, or even 13 Republicans and 2 Democrats. That would be difficult to do, but that's certainly something we're going to be watching for.
Does that idea seem to be gaining any traction in Ohio, Karen, or can you tell at this point?
We can't really tell at this point because so much of the oxygen for lawmakers was with the budget for a while. And you know, Governor Mike DeWine vetoed 67 items in the budget. So lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, have been talking about coming back and overriding some of those vetoes. The House has overridden one. That's the only thing that's happened so far. So there really hasn't been a whole lot of talk among legislative leaders publicly about what they plan to do about redistricting, but that's coming up very, very shortly. And in comments before, House Speaker Matt Huffman had said that he would be okay with a status quo map, meaning the map that exists right now, 10 Republicans, 5 Democrats, though some of these Democratic districts are very competitive. But with the pressure coming from President Trump, there's the possibility that that could really change as this process goes forward. So we're still waiting for lawmakers to put out a map. Maps are certainly being prepared behind the scenes, but we haven't seen any publicly yet.
Hmm. Well, Sylvia, that leaves Kentucky. Republicans control the state legislature there, too. Is there any talk about Kentucky trying to redraw its congressional map?
You know, I haven't heard any yet. We redrew our maps in 2022. There was a court challenge from Democrats over those, and the maps stood as they are. You know, when various groups, nonpartisan groups, rate the maps about you know, how gerrymandered they are, Kentucky actually usually scores pretty well. They largely adhere to historical kind of lines, although of course there is partisanship happening in there. The most perhaps infamous example is the quote unquote Comer hook. That would be one of our congressmen for Western Kentucky. He has a little hook that goes up to include a blue area in Frankfort, but largely the maps are considered less partisan than some other areas like in Texas or Illinois. And also, to be fair, Republicans have it pretty good in the in Congress, in our congressional delegation. We have 5 Republicans, 1 Democrat, and most of those congressional districts are considered relatively safe. The only one that Democrats are trying to go after in this midterm is Andy Barr's district. That includes Lexington, and it's currently controlled by a Republican. But I haven't heard anything yet. It's worth noting, Kentucky is a part-time legislature. They will reconvene in January, but they're not allowed to come back of their own volition. The governor would have to call them back, and it's pretty hard to imagine Democratic Governor Andy Beshear calling them back for redistricting. So we certainly, I would expect we won't hear about it, if at all, until January.
I want to just follow up on that. And like Sylvia just said about Kentucky, Indiana, lawmakers can't come back of their own volition before January, really. There is a single date in November, but they don't generally do anything legislative on that day. It's called Organization Day. It's primarily ceremonial. The governor has to call a special session, which obviously in Indiana, there's a Republican governor. So that would happen if they wanted to redraw the districts. But that would also cost taxpayer dollars. Well, Indiana is in the midst of a really bad budget crunch where they've cut hundreds of millions of dollars to key programs in the new budget that just took effect. So it would look bad even among Republicans, if they called a special session just to redraw the maps, they still might do it. But that is one of the factors.
And Ohio has a full-time legislature, so they can come back and do whatever they want, whenever they want. Though I think there's a story on our website today about how the State House right now has no electricity because they're renovating the 164-year-old building. And so that's going to keep them away for at least this week. But it's they can come back whenever they want.
Well, we're talking about regional politics for the full hour today. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Sylvia, you mentioned Kentucky's part-time legislature. I mean, the next session is a budget session, too. Doesn't that usually keep lawmakers pretty busy?
Oh, it's going to be very busy. It's the longer session, so they'll be quite tied up for some time with that budget. But, you know, I'm not 100% sure what the big questions of that budget are going to be. I imagine they'll have to do with all the various federal changes that have happened. So it's going to be an interesting budget year for sure as well.
Well, Brandon and Karen, I know it is perilous at best to predict what legislatures will do. But what do you think? What do you think the odds are that Republicans in Ohio or Indiana will redraw these maps to try to help President Trump in the midterms? These are two states that went big for President Trump.
Indiana's not going to lead the charge here, right? I mean, so this all started with Texas. Texas hasn't been able to go through with their plan yet. And if they hold off, whether because they choose to or because they're forced to, I don't think you'll see the Democratic states, California, Illinois, New York, who's talked about responding. I don't think they'll do anything. And so that might just settle the waters. But if Texas redraws its maps and that triggers democratically controlled states redrawing theirs, there will be so much pressure on Indiana trifecta states, governor, both houses of the legislature, particularly one like Indiana, where it's a supermajority and Democrats can't stop it. There will be so much pressure on Republicans here. I'd be stunned if they don't give in to that pressure.
And I think Brandon's right about that when it comes to Ohio as well. I mean, when you start talking about redoing Ohio's map from 10 Republicans, 5 Democrats, that's 2/3 Republicans in Congress in a state that Trump only won by 55%. But if you went all the way to a 12-3 map, that would be 80% Republican representation in Congress from a state that voted for Trump 55%. So, I mean, you're really starting to tip far over, but Republicans say that this would be more representative. And like Brandon said, there's going to be the pressure potentially if other Democratic states redistrict. Well, then Republican trifecta states are going to be asked to jump on board too, I think.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about, and we will continue our regional politics show after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about regional politics for the full hour today. My guests are Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith, Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman, and Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. If you have questions or comments about the issues we're discussing, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. I want to talk now about ICE detentions. Immigration and Customs Enforcement's been another big priority of the Trump administration. Karen, I know the Franklin County Courthouse passed some rules about ICE arrests there. Can you tell us what they did?
Honestly, I can't.
Okay.
we don't cover county governments as much, but certainly there's been talk around the state about law enforcement cooperating with ICE. You've got certainly Republican sheriffs in areas, I mean, like Butler County, you saw the sheriff there put up an AI photo on X about how he had surrounded the Butler County jail with alligators, kind of like the alligator Alcatraz, as it's been nicknamed in Florida. I mean, you certainly have support in Republican strongholds in the state for what ICE has been doing, but Democratic officials and cities are run by Democrats in Ohio for the most part, have been really pushing back and raising concerns about what ICE might be doing. So this is, I think it's one more time where you're seeing a struggle with local officials and federal government. It's to be expected, I think, in this environment.
Sure. And I'm sorry to have thrown you a curveball there. My understanding is that Franklin County had rules preventing ICE arrests at the courthouse during proceedings, and then that a state senator has proposed legislation to change that with Senate Bill 172 that would require county courthouses to allow those kinds of arrests to happen. Has there been much talk about that?
Well, I think we're seeing that there was another bill that specifically would require the kind of go the other way if, for some reason, the federal government started to make moves on seizing people's weapons. It's called the Second Amendment Protection Act, and it would say that the federal government couldn't do that, but that there would be partnerships with ICE and other entities. I mean, I think lawmakers are trying to, Republican lawmakers are walking this line of showing support for the things that they think the government is doing correctly when it comes to ICE enforcement, but then saying that there's also a concern about if the government changes hands, so to speak. So I think the issue of immigration in Ohio has not been as big a deal as it is in other states, just because we are perceived not to have as many immigrants, but clearly Ohio does. I mean, when you look, for instance, at the legal immigration in Springfield and how that became a huge issue in the presidential campaign, and you've got now 15,000 Haitian immigrants in the Springfield area who are going to lose their temporary protected status and are having to plan ahead to either self-deport or prepare for what's next. It is an issue in Ohio, and local and state lawmakers are starting to react.
Well, and Sylvia, I don't mean to throw a local news curveball question at you, but I understand the city of Louisville has changed its detention policy for immigrants following pressure from the Trump administration. Is that anything you've been following? I guess I'm wondering what changed there.
Yeah, I have been following that. Based in Louisville here, and basically Mayor Craig Greenberg, who is a Democrat, has essentially, he said that pressure from the Trump administration has caused him to change the city's policy. They had labeled Louisville as a sanctuary city because the city does not currently, or I should say the Louisville Department of Corrections does not currently or did not currently put on a extra 48-hour hold. It's like these immigration detainers that ICE requests so that they have 48 hours to come pick people up beyond the end of their jail sentence, if you will, or when they're supposed to be released. And Greenberg said that he would, in fact, bring that policy back in response to pressure from the Trump administration. Fear over losing funding, fear over a potential lawsuit caused him to bring back that hold. That's caused concerns from various groups, including immigration lawyers and rights groups and the ACLU. They've taken a lot of issue, and Kentucky, this is not just a Louisville issue, this is really across the state, but Louisville in particular has an issue with overcrowding in our jails. We've had a number of deaths in our jails, and the ACLU's contention is that's partially because there's not appropriate staffing, there's not appropriate, oversight inside the facility. And so their concern beyond, working with ICE is that there's simply not the space to do a 48-hour detainer, that there's not the space, there's not the staffing, and that it's going to lead to even more dangerous conditions within the jail.
Mm. And the mayor made that change because the federal government said, hey, we might withhold some funding if you don't?
Yes, it was pretty directly linked. I mean, the same day that Mayor Craig Greenberg made the announcement, Kristi Noem tweeted, Louisville should be an example for other cities in, adhering to what we have to say and what we want.
Hmm. Well, Brandon, my understanding is the Braun administration pledged to do more to help the federal government deport people. Talk about what state agencies in Indiana have done.
Yeah, well, first, there's already a state law in Indiana. It's been on the books for a long time, and it was given extra teeth in 2024 in terms of enforceability. There was already a state law on the books that said no local government entity can refused to cooperate with federal immigration authorities. So in the case of, you know, what you saw in Louisville, the so-called sanctuary city status, that wasn't possible in Indiana. And there have been, in fact, lawsuits filed by the Indiana Attorney General in the last couple of years to ensure that any communities that he deemed to be out of compliance with that law were cooperating in whatever way possible. But what Governor Braun recently announced was a step beyond just cooperation with what are called 287G agreements with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, with ICE. So under the 287G agreements, you're basically, the analogy I've used is that you have some state personnel who basically become deputized by the federal government to act as federal immigration agents. So in Indiana's case, those agreements were signed with the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Correction, the State Police, and the Indiana National Guard. And what that will involve is, and it hasn't really started yet in any significant way. They've just signed the agreements and announced them. But that'll involve potentially Indiana State Police troopers who are arresting people at ICE's request and certainly detaining them. The State Department of Correction has offered its Miami Correctional Facility, which is in the north central part of the state. They've offered 1,000 beds to ICE to detain people suspected of being undocumented. The Indiana National Guard's training center in Camp Atterbury will be used by federal authorities to detain people. So the Indiana's already complying and cooperating with the federal government. Again, a Republican-run state, and a lot of local governments are Republican-led. And the ones who aren't were basically forced to by state law. But these 287G agreements, which are relatively rare in Indiana, they take it a significant step further.
Wow, 1,000 beds seems like a lot. Is it that big of an issue in Indiana with people who are there and with undocumented status that they need 1,000 beds?
I mean, I don't know that they'll use all 1,000. It's just what the facility has capacity for. But it's really important to note, because some of the issue that's come up here, and we've talked to Governor Braun about it recently, is, you know, is the state, again, I referenced this earlier in the show, in a budget crunch, I would argue even a crisis, but certainly in a budget crunch that Indiana's currently in, can it afford to be devoting state resources to federal immigration enforcement? And Governor Braun insists that he will seek, federal funds in response for whatever Indiana does to help the feds. They're gonna seek compensation for that. In the case of the prison, that's going to be kind of important on the front end, because the reason there are 1,000 beds available is because Indiana doesn't have the staff to be able to house any people in those 1,000 beds. So if the federal government wants to use that facility to house people they've arrested, that ICE has arrested and detained, they're going to need to get some money together, because Indiana's already dug through the couch cushions when writing its new state budget. There's not spare money laying around. They're going to need some help.
My couch cushions usually just have cat hair, but I know what you mean. There's some people.
Well, that's about all they seem to find when they tried to write the new state budget, too.
Okay. I want to remind our listeners, we're talking about regional politics for the entire show today. You can join the conversation. Call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. I want to shift gears a little bit now and talk about affordable housing and property taxes. And Sylvia, quality affordable housing is a huge issue in Greater Cincinnati. You've reported on the Louisville Tenants Union. Can you talk to us about what they're doing to expand beyond the city?
Yeah, you know, and affordable housing is an issue across Kentucky. And I think we talk about it a lot in an urban context, but it's really an issue everywhere, including in rural areas. There's a real lack of of housing that is affordable for lower income folks and for middle income, which means that it really just kind of compresses on lower income folks because, you know, it's the housing is just not affordable really for anyone. And so it really affects the lowest income folks the most. And, you know, I was reporting on this earlier this month about the Louisville Tenants Union, which obviously in the name, it's focused on Louisville. They've actually started expanding to include some properties that are in rural areas, which is really fascinating to me. Tenants unions have been around for a long time, but I think they're kind of picking up a little bit more steam in recent years. They don't have quite the same formal structure and federal oversight as, say, labor unions have. But it's really interesting to see. And kind of their argument for it is that property owners in Louisville, they own property around the state. You know, sometimes we're talking about federally subsidized housing. And that if they want to create change in properties they see in Louisville, they have to include all the properties and kind of expand outward into rural areas. Rural areas, especially, there's, you know, I've talked to various advocates and you know, legal aid people who talk about the fact that there's really just not the same resources if you have an issue with your landlord in a rural area. And so I think that's kind of what this effort is to make sure that people, even if they're in rural area in affordable housing, that they're able to, you know, get the accommodations that they deserve, make sure that they have working AC units, they have pest control, all of these things that, you know, you can sue for, say, in Louisville, but maybe the same protections don't exist in other areas. So, yeah, that was a story I was reporting on. It's just kind of this expansion into rural areas.
Well, and Sylvia, I know in terms of statewide impact, didn't state lawmakers last year pass a law that stops local governments from banning source of income discrimination?
That was actually 2 years ago, I think.
2 years ago, okay.
Yeah, but there's been a lot of efforts to kind of constrict how local governments can manage landlords, I would say, in Kentucky. So, right, there was that law, that source of income. That's really specifically, we're talking about vouchers. We're talking about like the federal government subsidizing you. So if you don't make enough money, you can still get affordable housing. So, you know, Louisville and Lexington, while that law was being passed, were trying to make it so that landlords can't discriminate on people just because they have those vouchers. And the state lawmaker said, no, you can't do that. Landlords have the right to discriminate based on source of income. And then more recently, we had an issue in Louisville that we reported on about state lawmakers essentially threatened that they would pass this bill that made it so you can't have any rental registries. You can't require landlords to register with the city unless Louisville severely restricted its own policies about lead. So, you know, they had a lead registry that required landlords whose house was built before a certain time to have lead inspections and to report that to the city. And the lawmakers in Frankfurt said, if you don't get rid of that policy or you don't severely change it, then we're going to pass this law that would affect a lot more people and a lot of other efforts. So Louisville did, in fact, go ahead and change that based on that threat from Frankfurt. So, I mean, we're just seeing a lot of push and pull here. State lawmakers are also passing policies to encourage affordable housing development. I mean, it's just this really push and pull of how should the state and the city and local governments be involved in making sure that there is housing available for people who want it and, you know, however they are able to pay for it.
Karen, the big housing topic that we've been talking to you about so many times is property taxes in Ohio and the increase in property tax that so many people paid. Are state lawmakers getting anywhere with this, trying to tackle that problem?
Well, the first thing I'll note is that there were some changes that were proposed in the budget on affordable housing that actually were reversed. So affordable housing advocates in Ohio are pleased that the Republican leadership in the House didn't go forward with plans that they say would have really put their affordable housing policies into a concerning place here. But when it comes to property taxes, there were four items that were related to property taxes in the budget. They were among the 67 items that Governor Mike DeWine vetoed last month. And the legislature tried to come back last month to override some of those vetoes. They were only able to override one, and it really only affects property taxes going forward and specific kinds of property tax levies that schools can put onto the ballot. So the problem still exists in Ohio, essentially. And so when DeWine vetoed these items, he created this working group of 11 members who he says are charged with coming up with recommendations that will not only help struggling homeowners and farmers to pay their property taxes, but also preserves local funding for schools, law enforcement, libraries, all of those entities that are funded with property taxes. Because there was one item that DeWine vetoed that would have required school districts who collect voter-approved property taxes to refund anything over 40% of their operating budget back to taxpayers. School said that would just create chaos. So this working group is now meeting to try to come up with some recommendations. They have until the end of next month, and we're waiting to see what happens. Meanwhile, there is an effort to try to put a ballot issue before voters next fall that would abolish property taxes in Ohio entirely. And lawmakers and local officials and others are very, very carefully watching that.
Didn't a legislative commission already make recommendations for property tax law changes, Karen?
Yeah, there were 21 recommendations that were developed. And when I talked to a longtime Republican lawmaker, Bill Seitz, who is the chair of this working group, he left the House last year, but he's obviously still has his hand in state politics. He said that some of those recommendations were contradictory. Some of those recommendations really didn't have a whole lot of meet in terms of how they would be enacted. And so this working group is designed to come up with recommendations that can be put into effect, that DeWine can bring to lawmakers and say, this would work. And one of the things that he said the working group is opposed to is this 40% cap that Republican lawmakers put in the budget that DeWine vetoed. And he says he wants to see actually a bill that would tie property tax valuation to inflation so that homeowners wouldn't potentially have their property taxes go up dramatically. And so this is what this group is trying to work on here. And they have a fairly short timeline to come up with something.
Well, we got a call a little bit earlier in the program from Charles, who asks, how much influence are developers having with regards to abatements? I think he's talking more generally about some of these changes to property tax laws. And did the lobbying groups for the organizations that depend on these taxes know a change was coming when it comes to property taxes? Karen, do you have a feel for the role that lobbying groups are playing in all this?
Well, I talked to Seitz about abatement specifically, and that's another area that another Cincinnati Republican, Senator Blessing, has been talking about, saying that tax abatements are a big reason why the burden of property taxes is far more on homeowners and farmers than it is on commercial property owners in Ohio. It used to be almost even. Now it's like homeowners pay like 62.5%. That's their burden for property taxes for schools and local entities versus about 32.5% for commercial properties. And tax abatements are considered to be some of that. Seitz says he wants to see schools have more of a voice in local tax abatements that are issued as incentives for businesses and others to come to communities. So that's certainly an issue that's been talked about. And obviously, businesses have used tax abatements and they've been used in not just in cities, but all over the state of Ohio.
Hmm. Well, Brandon, I want to talk about affordable housing in Indiana, too, because a report found a gap between what it takes to afford a two-bedroom apartment in Indiana and the typical wage there. Tell us a little bit about that and whether that's something that's a problem all over Indiana.
It is. It's a problem everywhere in Indiana, not just the cities. You know, just something Sylvia talked about, that it's arguably sometimes even worse in rural areas. That's true just as much as Indiana. Yes, it's hard to find an affordable place to live in Indianapolis or Gary or Evansville or Fort Wayne, but it's also really hard to find in Indiana's rural counties. So that report you just referenced, which is a story that I did recently, it's from a national group that does reports for all of these states every year, and it's been going on for several years. Indiana has never been good in that report. Its median or its average renter wage, that is a hard phrase to say, its average renter wage has never been what it takes to afford a basic median two-bedroom apartment anywhere in the state of Indiana. In fact, it's something like 90 of the 92 counties, those two things don't match. So it's a problem everywhere. And it's also a problem that Indiana's basically about the worst in the Midwest for some of these measures too. So yeah, it's easy to, you know, it's easy to write off, oh, well, we're not, you know, our rental wages aren't as good as they are on the coasts and stuff like that. But even when you're comparing to neighboring states, Indiana's just not doing very well.
And I would add that Indiana, I believe in that report, is 38th. Ohio is 37th. So yeah, it's Brandon's absolutely right that that is a problem that exists throughout the country in terms of the ability of people to afford housing based on the wages that they make.
Well, we will be back after a short break to wrap up our regional politics show. If you've got questions, call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wbxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our regional politics show. My guests are Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman, Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, and Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. You can join the conversation. Call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. I want to talk a little bit about Medicaid, because that has been such a big topic of conversation all across the country. Certainly, we know we have listeners who are concerned about this. Brandon, what is the latest on what the federal changes to Medicaid will mean for Indiana? Is there an expectation that people there could lose coverage as a result of these changes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, you've seen analyses of this federal legislation that show Medicaid losses in every state, and Indiana is no different. Indiana lawmakers actually already, before this federal bill, they spent this last legislative session from January through April crafting their own legislation around Medicaid, mirroring a lot of what you see at the federal level, which is more regularly checking whether people are still eligible to be on Medicaid and trying to limit. So as a way to potentially kick people off who don't pass those eligibility checks, although there's concerns about, are they passing them because they're not eligible, or are they passing them because they struggle with the administrative side of things? So they already tried to do some of that. There are wait lists for care, both for older Hoosiers as well as medically frail children. And that's simply because the portion of the state budget that funds Medicaid in Indiana has been growing exponentially, outpacing every other part of Indiana's budget. And lawmakers here are really concerned that at some point it's going to grow to be such a big part that you're going to have to, they're just not going to have enough money to spend on the other things they have to spend money on, notably K through 12 education. So you've already seen lawmakers here at the state level trying to shrink that pie a little bit. But also importantly, this federal legislation is putting limits on how much states can collect from hospitals and managed care entities and what are called hospital assessment fees and managed care fees in order to fund healthcare programs like Medicaid. That's how Indiana has Indiana's hospital assessment fee funds its Medicaid expansion program. Well, the federal government doesn't want those to be very high anymore. And so Indiana's now, and Indiana's trying to get a managed care assessment fee for the first time ever, and they're struggling to get the feds to approve one at all. If they don't have funds from those, you're going to see a catastrophic hit to healthcare access in Indiana.
Karen, what's it look like in Ohio?
Well, in Ohio's budget, and this goes back to the initial budget proposed by Governor Mike DeWine, there's language in the budget that would trigger the end of Medicaid expansion in Ohio if there are changes at the federal level. For instance, right now, Ohio's Medicaid expansion is funded 90% by the federal government. If that percentage drops, then Medicaid expansion would end. And that's about 770,000 Ohioans who are in the Medicaid expansion population. And, you know, the mega bill, the so-called big, beautiful bill that was passed at the federal level recently, there's cuts to Medicaid expansion in that. And so there's certainly concerns at the state level about what would happen to the Medicaid expansion population. But like Brandon just said, Ohio's Medicaid rolls have been growing. They're lower than they were at their height, but there are concerns about how to make it less than what has been called for the longest time that I can remember, the Pac-Man of the state budget. And so Ohio will ask for, it's asking for a waiver to allow people to require work to demonstrate that they are either working, they're in a training program, they're in school, something like that, for 20 hours a week. There's also a part of the budget that would require eligibility checks every 6 months instead of every year. So there are certainly some efforts that those who support them say will keep the Medicaid rolls down and make sure that Medicaid's only going to people who really need it. But advocates say it just puts up obstacles in front of people who really do need the coverage to stay employed and to even get a job in the first place.
Kentucky, what do things look like in Kentucky when it comes to Medicaid, not only for patients, but for hospitals?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the big issues we've been hearing about lately. The Kentucky Hospital Association, they actually supported the first version of this bill when it passed the House. They said that they were involved with that process. They said they felt it allowed them to continue their services. Now, there are other hospital associations around the country who did not feel that way, but Kentucky stood out as one that the hospital association said it was okay. They could continue providing services under that version. The final version is, I suppose, was the straw that broke the camel's back, and they have come out in strong opposition to the bill now. They say that it will cost them, it'll cost thousands of jobs around this, tens of thousands of jobs in around the state, that hospitals will likely close, that services are going to be cut because of the bill. And it really comes down to what Brandon was talking about, which is these directed payments, these state-directed payments and provider taxes. Essentially, what those do is they help the state and the federal government bring up the reimbursements for Medicaid services to not the same, but similar levels to private insurers. Hospitals say that the whatever Medicaid is willing to reimburse is simply not enough. Those provider taxes, which basically the provider taxes allow, cover the state's portion of that, and then the federal government matches. So the state doesn't have to put up quite so much, and the provider taxes will cover that. And essentially, what it's doing, hospitals say, is they're just not going to have the money to provide all these services, that they're going to have to cut staff, they're going to have to close hospitals. Some estimates, there's one estimate from the Shep Center that says Kentucky will lose the most rural hospitals of any state. I think their number was 35. The argument that the Kentucky Hospital Association is making is that that doesn't just affect people on Medicaid, right? If the hospital in your area cuts their labor and delivery department because they can't afford it anymore because they don't have these directed payments, that doesn't just affect someone who has Medicaid in that community. That affects someone who has private insurance. They can no longer go to that hospital when they need to give birth. They have to travel much farther distances. So there's a lot of concern right now. I think there's concern from both Republicans and Democrats, although there's still some hope that this rural hospital fund that was included in the bill, this rural health fund, I should say, will help with some transformative effort to change the state's healthcare system to make rural healthcare more sustainable in the future, less reliant on federal money. But there's a lot of fear right now, especially from the Kentucky Hospital Association and various, independent providers in these regions of Kentucky that are, more rural, more dependent on Medicaid dollars, that they simply won't be able to survive.
Karen, are hospitals concerned in Ohio?
Yes. In fact, Ohio's rural hospitals just in the last week created a task force to lobby for a little bit more say in how the money from that bill is spent. They're concerned. There are 11 rural hospitals that were listed as potentially in danger with some of the actions at the federal level. So rural hospitals in Ohio are very concerned about what's happening at the federal level, and they're hoping to work together to try to get a little bit more say in what happens.
And one more note as it relates to state budgets. You know, we talked about how this affects people who have to, the 6-month eligibility checks, the increased eligibility checks, the increased work requirements. You know, that also should be taken account into state budgets. It's going to take more administrative staff to process all of those. So I think a lot of states, including Kentucky, are currently kind of trying to figure out what more do we need to allocate just for administrative costs of our Medicaid program now.
Brandon, what does the hospital picture look like in Indiana with these changes?
Yeah, I mean, they're not thrilled. I mean, a lot of the stuff on the hospitals have been comfortable with the hospital assessment fees they've been paying for a long time, because that was an agreement they reached with the state under then Governor Mike Pence for Medicaid expansion. And the hospitals were supportive of that, because if folks aren't insured, they're coming to the emergency room. Hospitals have to treat them. And so that's now a cost being borne on the hospitals themselves. So they were supportive of that, because it helped get those uninsured numbers down. I think what we're about to see a struggle with is if that hospital assessment fee is capped in Indiana below what it's currently at, that's where the problem's going to come in. Because, you know, like others have mentioned, there's also legislation in Indiana's law that if federal support for its Medicaid expansion program dips, Indiana could get rid of the expansion entirely, maybe try to build something new. But there's a question budget-wise whether they'd be able to do that at all. And so now you're looking at, I mean, I think the latest numbers I saw in terms of Indiana's Medicaid expansion is like north of 600 or even 700,000 people who theoretically might lose their health coverage.
Karen, Sylvia was just talking about the kind of bureaucratic costs of having these additional check-ins every 6 months to make sure people are employed or still eligible for Medicaid. Is that something that worries the Ohio system too?
Oh, advocates have really said that those kinds of things don't catch waste, fraud, and abuse to the point that people would hope that they do. And they really do put up barriers in the way of folks who are just trying to maintain their Medicaid coverage, because it does take time to not only do those forms, but to remember to do those forms, to gather all the information that you need and all that. There's a group called the Health Policy Institute of Ohio that tried to estimate what the cost of ending Medicaid expansion would be in Ohio in a related area. And while the state would potentially save some money if the federal match dropped, because the state has argued that if the federal match drops, it can't afford to keep people on Medicaid expansion, the Health Policy Institute of Ohio has said that there could be a huge impact in the billions of dollars for the state if indeed Medicaid expansion completely ends, because there's federal money that comes to that that the state can also use to grow the economy. So It's tough. It's a tough system.
Well, I've been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith, and Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Great to talk to you.
Great to be here.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez-Cornu. And Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.